Stay tuned now for Dr. Steven Zelikoff and a program you will not want to miss. Bone Talk. That's Bone Talk with Dr. Steven Zelikoff on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome, everybody. This is Dr. Steven Zelikoff, and happy to have everybody with me today for another session of Bone Talk. Today, I'm going to be touching base on some common questions that people have regarding hip arthritis. It's something that, unfortunately, affects lots and lots of patients. It's very debilitating, and there's lots of misconceptions that are out there. Unfortunately, people go to the internet, and they get a lot of bad information. So I'm hoping to just share some thoughts about what hip arthritis is. We'll talk a little about the anatomy of the hip, what are some common causes of hip arthritis, and then we'll talk a little bit about what you can expect at a doctor's visit, and then we'll talk about treatments, both non-operative, non-surgical treatments, and then a little bit about surgical treatments, including things such as hip replacements. So to start off, what is the hip? It's basically it's a joint. It matches your pelvis to your thigh bone. It's located near your groin and buttock area. And the hip is a ball and socket joint, and it connects the femur, which is your thigh bone, into your pelvis. It's round. The ball is round, and there's a concave and a convex surface where the ball articulates or rubs within the socket. Both the ball and socket have a nice thick coating of cartilage. The cartilage is the lining that makes up most of our joints. It moves smoothly. There's no pain with motion. And around the hip, it provides a great deal of comfortable motion. And the motions that we commonly see around the hip are things such as bringing your thigh up and down, putting on your shoes and socks, things like getting out of a car, rotating your leg, crossing your legs, things of that nature are the motions that oftentimes comes from the hip. And unfortunately, when people develop arthritis or an injury to the hip area, a lot of the symptoms affect those common motions. So things like walking, things like putting on your shoes and socks, cutting your toenails, things of that nature, which we take for granted, become limited and painful. So what are some common causes of hip arthritis? Well, mostly it's osteoarthritis. And osteoarthritis is a wear and tear phenomenon. And it comes from overuse, and as we age, the joints tend to wear to some extent. But some people wear at different rates, and sometimes you'll have one bad hip and one normal hip, and some of it can come from an injury that you may have had when you were younger. A lot of times something called hip dysplasia can occur. What hip dysplasia is that when we're born, what can happen is that the socket and the ball don't fit perfectly together, and it may be something that's never picked up until you get older. And what happens is because they're not completely well aligned, it can predilect or lead to earlier arthritis or wearing away of the joint surface. Genetics certainly is a part. Oftentimes my patients come in, and they may say that, you know, my mom had her hip replaced, my dad had his hip replaced, I've got two brothers that have all had their hip replacements, and then, you know, why do I have a hip? And, you know, well, the chances are is that there is a component of genetics in terms of the way your cartilage develops, in terms of the resiliency of the cartilage, in terms of being able to cushion, and the likelihood that you may go on to develop some wear and tear. Weight is certainly a factor as well. As a nation, we've become bigger, and obesity certainly can affect your joints, not just your hip, but your knee and your other weight-bearing joints as well. There's a 4-to-1 ratio in terms of weight, so every extra 10 pounds that you carry, your hip sees 40. So that even times taking a little bit of weight off can make a big difference in terms of how you feel, but it also puts a huge amount of stress on your joints as well. So if you think about, again, where the hip is, again, I mentioned before is that it's commonly in the area of the groin, and people that have arthritis of the hip or a hip injury often come in and they say that I've got pain in my groin, I've got pain that radiates down my leg to some extent, it's uncomfortable if I put on my shoes and socks, when I cut my toenails, if I get in out of a car, and I just find that I'm starting to limp a little bit. And people will oftentimes say, like, you know, why are you walking funny? Why are you limping a little bit? And I think that these are the kinds of common questions that people tend to have. Now, keep in mind is that there's other things that can cause pain in the area around the groin and down your leg. Always you have to think about lower back symptoms, sometimes arthritis around the spine, something called spinal stenosis or sciatica can give people symptoms that tend to radiate down the leg and can also be associated with various symptoms. So it's something that it's not always hip arthritis. The other things that can lead to problems and pain around the area of the hip, or you can have a hernia. And it's something that if you've been told that you may have had a hernia in the past, or if you continue to have pain in your groin, particularly if you bear down during when you go to the bathroom, or if you're sneezing or coughing, if the symptoms increase, that's something that you may want to go ahead and have checked out. Additionally, if you've had an acute injury, there's always the risk of a fracture where you can end up with a broken bone, either in the pelvis or in the hip. Or alternatively, there's lots of muscles and tendons in the area of the hip that, you know, as an athlete, particularly if you're a runner, oftentimes you can end up with either with a stress fracture or you can end up with a strain of the muscles around the hip. And those are big muscles around the back. The gluteus muscles that make up your buttock can get strained and irritated. But there's also a big tendon that goes through the joint called the iliopsoas tendon, which flexes or bends your hip. And oftentimes patients will get some soreness in that area, particularly with stairs, particularly with stairs or trying to lift their leg up and down. So it's a rather complex issue, and I think that there's lots of things that can cause it. So just because you have pain in your groin doesn't mean necessarily that you have arthritis. But particularly the important thing is that if things continue to bother you and they don't get better and, you try taking some Tylenol and it doesn't help, you try a little bit of icing and it doesn't help, and this is becoming more and more limiting for you, I think that's not a bad idea at that point to go ahead and see your doctor. You can certainly start out with your internist and have somebody just evaluate you. Alternatively, you can go ahead and see your orthopedic surgeon. Now, what happens when you get to the doctor's office in terms of what can you expect? Well, I think the first thing is that what you can do is to try to go ahead and make your visit the best that it can be and the most useful. And the things that I recommend to my patients is, number one, write down your questions. So if you have any thoughts or any questions, or if you're going for a second opinion, write things down on a piece of paper. Oftentimes you're in the office, you get wrapped up in the visit, and then you sort of feel like you're rushed and you don't have the opportunity to ask the questions that you want. So write them down and make sure that you know what you're going to ask and what you're curious about. The other thing is to make sure that you if you can, bring a family member or a friend. It's always helpful to have another set of ears when you go to a doctor's office because that's always helpful to just, be able to have somebody else that can answer some questions. And also, if you're not sure what exactly was said at the visit, to make sure that you have the ability to go ahead and have another person that can recount those that experience for you. Make sure that you have, if you have any x-rays or imaging studies such as MRIs, make sure you bring them. And then make sure that you have a list of all your medications or your medical history so that when you go ahead and allergies, so this way when the doctor asks you if there's a physician's assistant or nurse practitioner that's there that can ask you the questions, this way you'll have a good set of information. Because the more we know about you, the more we can do to help you. When you get to the office, oftentimes a good history is obtained so that most likely people ask you how long has the symptoms been going on, what causes it to get worse, what makes it better, where is the pain located, and I think those are the things that you want to be able to articulate and discuss with the doctor. Once that happens, then you'll oftentimes have a physical examination. The physical examination will usually involve watching you walk. And then there'll be a physical examination looking at the range of motion of your hip. The nice part with hips is that you have two of them, so oftentimes the doctor will compare one side to the other. And then they may also want to look at the other parts of your body, particularly since hip pain can radiate down your leg. There may be an examination of your spine as well as of your knees and also of your feet as well to make sure that the blood supply to your leg is good and that the nervous system that feeds your lower extremity is also intact. once a good physical examination has been performed. And also make sure that when you go to the doctor's office, wear loose-fitting clothing. It'll make it easier to examine you. It's easier for you to get dressed afterwards. So make sure you wear something that's loose and comfortable that you can put on and off easily. And if you have a pair of shorts that you want to bring, that also makes it easier as well. X-rays are oftentimes done at that time. I think that X-rays are very, very valuable, particularly looking at hip pathology in terms of seeing if there's any fractures there, how much the arthritis is, comparing it to the other hip. And I think that's something that most physicians will go ahead and look at. MRIs are helpful as well, but oftentimes the MRI is not as helpful when looking at arthritis because most of the imaging that we want to see is with the quality of the bone, the amount of joint space that there is. We compare it to from one hip to the other, and the determinations in terms of how we treat you is usually best made on an X-ray. The value of the X-ray also is that if you do need surgery at some point in the future, the X-rays are often used to template or determine the size of the implants that you're going to have placed inside, and then the type of fixation, the way that the implant's going to be fixed into your bone. So these are all important things, and you can anticipate to have an X-ray. If you've had X-rays that were done elsewhere, make sure that you bring them with you. It's often helpful to compare X-rays from the past to where you are today. So again, make sure that you have them available. That's particularly helpful. Once you sort of have had your X-rays and your exam, at that point the physician will go ahead and try to review with you what your treatment options are. And the treatment options, particularly for arthritis of the hip, really depend an awful lot on you. I think that it depends on how long the symptoms have been present, what you've done for the symptoms, what your health is like. Is something that surgery even an option for you because of a medical history, and whether it be a problem with your heart, your lungs, high blood pressure, diabetes? Do you have any other comorbidities, such as do you smoke? Do you take any other medications? And then also what your allergies are regarding to different types of nickel, metal, jewelry, things like that, latex allergies. So all these are important in terms of determining whether you're a surgical candidate and what happens during the surgical procedure. Initially, most surgical treatments are non-operative, which means that we don't operate. I tend to look at surgery as a last resort, mostly because there's no such thing as a small operation when it's on you. Mostly initially when patients come in, particularly if they haven't had symptoms for very long, we talk about figuring out exactly what the problem is and if the issue is arthritis. Oftentimes I'll start with a course of physical therapy to try to improve their gait, the way you walk, and make sure that improve your balance and as well as the flexibility and how well your hip moves. Because the problem is that with arthritis of the hip, since the hip isn't moving, the muscles around your hip become weaker because they're not functioning the way they need to be. And the weaker those muscles are, they lead to more trouble after the surgery, if you need surgery, regarding being able to get back to walking without a limp and being able to function and doing the sports and the activities that you want to do. So the better you are coming into the procedure and the better you are in terms of being able to function and move, the better you're going to be afterwards. So oftentimes working with a physical therapist is often helpful. And that doesn't have to be for very long. Oftentimes it can just be for several weeks or a month, and usually once or twice a week. And then they give you a series of exercises that you can then do on yourself at home, focusing again on things like balance, range of motion, as well as exercises strengthening the muscles around your hip. The use of a cane is often very, very helpful. Mostly the cane is recommended to be used in the opposite hand. So if you have a bad right hip, I usually recommend that you go ahead and use the cane in your left side, in your left hand, and then use it to, as you step forward, to use the cane at the same time to try to offload the forces against across your hip. Unfortunately, a lot of my patients don't like the aesthetics of a cane. They feel that they might look old, and they feel that people may think there's something wrong with them. So what I would suggest is that if you, particularly early on, you can go to a sports store like REI or one of these places and even get a walking stick of some sort, and oftentimes that accomplishes the same thing. I've seen people use a putter upside down as a walking stick or as a cane. But again, trying to unload your hip is oftentimes very helpful. Altering activities. I mean, so the question is that if going ahead and walking 6 miles makes your hip feel worse, then you may want to walk 3 miles. I mean, so changing the activities that you do to try to go ahead and help your symptoms is oftentimes helpful. Also, changing the type of activity that you do. So if weight-bearing activities such as walking, jogging, are uncomfortable and they limit your activities, then possibly switch to something like cycling, which is less stressful on your hip joint. Also, the other alternative is to do something like swimming, particularly if you have access to a pool. Swimming is awesome in terms of getting you comfortable and regaining your mobility and your flexibility. So I think something that I would definitely recommend. Also, things like yoga, Pilates can also be very, very helpful. Particularly things like yoga are also useful, not just in terms of core strengthening and flexibility, but also in terms of balance. So going ahead and doing that is something that's very, very helpful. And certainly weight loss is something that's particularly helpful. As I mentioned at the beginning of our session, that every 10 pounds you take off, your hip sees 40. So taking off even, 10, 20 pounds can make a huge difference in terms of the way you feel. And it can oftentimes put off surgery, if need be, for a very long period of time. So those are the common things that we tend to look at from a non-surgical aspect. Medications are often helpful, and they can make you feel better. The medications that are commonly used are things such as Tylenol, which can help, anti-inflammatories, things like Advil, ibuprofen can often help. And there's other ones that are out there that are longer acting and are also very, very effective. The problem, unfortunately, with most medications is that they have side effects, and that even Tylenol can affect your liver if taken too much, and all the anti-inflammatories, things like Advil and ibuprofen, can raise your blood pressure and can give you an ulcer. So all these things can really have real side effects. So that's why I'm a huge fan of anti-inflammatories and of medications when taken for a short period of time. So again, if it's something that it helps and you're better within a few days, then great, or a week or two. But if you find that you've been taking these medicines now for 4 to 6 weeks and you haven't gotten better, then probably go ahead and seek out medical attention, because it may be something that needs to be treated in an alternate fashion so that you don't develop a side effect, such as a bleeding ulcer or something from too much medications. Injections sometimes can help transiently, like a cortisone shot into the hip. Unlike the knee, which you can inject fairly easily without any imaging studies, oftentimes if you're going to have an injection of cortisone into the hip, then it should be done under image guidance, something like fluoroscopy or x-ray guidance or ultrasound guidance, in order to make sure that the medicine is put in the right spot. The problem with injections is that they only help for a short period of time, particularly if the arthritis is fairly advanced. And they do increase the risk of infection. And if you do have an injection of cortisone into your hip, then there's data that's out there that indicates that you probably shouldn't have surgery for about 3 months because of increased risk of infection. So that if you think that you may need hip surgery, like a hip replacement, then it's probably a good idea to not have a cortisone shot into the hip joint because of the risk of infection. Additionally, cortisone, if you're diabetic, can also raise your blood sugar, and so that's something that can also be impacting and something that you need to be aware of. So once you've exhausted all your non-surgical options, then at that point we have to look at surgery as an alternative. If you find that your symptoms are really, really limiting you, you can't do the things you want to do, you get up in the morning and you're not happy with your daily activities, and mostly you're just not having fun anymore. Going for a walk with your friends, playing a little bit of golf is uncomfortable, picking up your grandkids isn't doing the way you need to do, or frankly, if you're still working, just going to work in the morning and getting in and out of a car, getting out of public transportation is more limiting, then at that point you need to think about going ahead and pursuing some type of a surgical intervention. When we look at hip surgery, the most common hip surgery that's performed is total hip replacement. Total hip replacement surgery is one of the most common procedures that's been performed over the years, probably one of the most successful operations of the 20th century in terms of reproducibility, patient satisfaction, longevity of the implant, and the ability to get people back to their normal activities with limited pain. So I think that it's something where if you need to have a hip replacement, then, you know, be comfortable with knowing that there's lots of people that have had it before you and that have done very, very well. What a hip replacement is, it's an implant that's made out of metal, and usually it's titanium or an alloy of titanium, which makes up the part that fits into your femur or the stem into your thigh bone. And the socket is made out of titanium as well. And there's a plastic shim usually that fits into the socket piece, and that makes up for the cartilage that you had originally in your hip. And the ball, instead of being made of bone at that point, the implant is made out of ceramic usually or metal. The benefit is that now most of the contemporary implants are really made at a very, very high standard, and the longevity of most implants at this point or can be over 30, 40, up to 50 years. The failure rates of most hip replacements are about 1% per year. So you have a 50-50 shot that the implant can last you 50 years. So it's really become sort of a lifetime implant. So I think that if you're 70 or if you're 75 and you've got a bad hip, then I think that you could be pretty comfortable that if you have a hip replacement and everything goes great, that this could last you the rest of your life potentially. As far as restrictions with total hip replacement in terms of what can and can't you do after a total hip, most people after contemporary hip replacements can go back to doing pretty much everything. The things that I tend to tell my patients is to try to avoid repetitive and long-distance running, to try to because I think that it does put more stress on the leg. But otherwise, you can walk, you can hike, you can play golf, tennis. I think that skiing is fine. Usually I tell people skiing to do it a level below where they normally skied before and try to avoid bumps and to try to avoid that last run of the day at 3 in the afternoon when the light's flat. But for the most part, I think that most people can go back to most of the activities that they need to do. I do have some restrictions. I recommend antibiotics if you go to the dentist or for a cleaning for a couple of years. But other than that, most of my patients are up pretty quickly. We usually get patients up the same day of surgery. Most patients are up walking the same day of surgery. We're now able to discharge people either the same day or the next day. So that you can anticipate that you're able to leave, and most likely you'll be either using a walker or a cane after surgery. So that makes a big difference in terms of your functionality and what you're able to do. As far as the procedure itself, we make sure that you're as healthy as possible. We usually have you see your medical doctor before, may occasionally have you see a heart doctor to make sure that your heart's okay prior to the operation. Most patients have a little bit of prehab, which is a physical therapy before the surgery, to try to make sure that you're as limber as you can be prior to the operation. And it also gives you the opportunity to get to know your therapist, and when you see them after the surgery, it's somebody that you know and you're comfortable with. Most of the operations are done under a regional anesthetic, like a spinal. You're sleepy and comfortable throughout the operation, but the nice part is that you mostly can avoid general anesthesia, which is oftentimes safer. As far as the different approaches to the hip, people have talked about the different approaches, the anterior approach, the posterior approach, there's a lateral approach. Basically, there's different ways of getting to the hip, and they all have certain advantages and disadvantages. I would suggest that you find an approach that your surgeon is comfortable with and that you let them go ahead and do whatever seems to work the best for them and what they've had the best results with. All the approaches that are out there at this point, if you look at outcomes, usually after about 4 to 6 weeks, there's no difference in terms of how people do, in terms of activities. And certainly approaches, particularly with anterior approach or a lateral approach, do have a series of potential complications that may be a little higher, particularly at the beginning if the surgeon isn't very familiar with that procedure. The surgery itself, usually there's an incision that's made around the hip. The muscles usually spread apart. Usually it's a muscle-sparing approach. And then the ball that's worn away is removed and an implant is placed inside. After the surgery, you're closed up. Usually we use glue to close it up so that there's no staples or stitches. And the dressing allows you to shower right away. As I mentioned before, most of my patients go home the same day or the next day, usually using anti-inflammatories and narcotics only for a few days. Afterwards, most of the people are just using Tylenol and an anti-inflammatory. Usually back to driving in about 2 weeks, and then back to walking and doing most of their activities, usually by about 4 to 6 weeks. It does take about 6 months to a year until most implants are part of you, but for the most part, you can anticipate that you can be back doing most of your activities rather quickly. I usually have people go back to playing golf usually about 2 to 3 months. And usually at about 6 weeks, I'll start them putting and chipping, and then adding about a club length a week afterwards until you're comfortable getting back into your golf game. So for the most part, it's a procedure that works very well. The risk factors that can occur with surgery are any type of risk factors such as infection, wound problems, blood clots, things like that. We give people medicine to make sure that those things don't happen. Instability is certainly a concern. We try to limit people's activities for the first few weeks, although at this point I'd let people do pretty much everything. The only thing I ask my patients to do is to just not cross their legs for the first 3-4 weeks, but otherwise they can do pretty much anything they want to do. They can sleep on their side, their stomach. We've really tried to get people back to doing the things that they feel most comfortable with. So I think the important thing to remember with total hip replacement is you don't have to live with pain. We can get you back to your activities and get you back to your life without pain and without limping, and hopefully return back to the things you enjoy doing. So I'm Dr. Steven Zelikoff. If you have any questions and you want to discuss this further with me, you can reach me at Specialty Orthopedics. My website is www.specialtyorthony.com, and you can reach us in our office at 914-686-0111. So enjoy your President's Day, and this is our version of Bone Talk. Hope to hear everybody and talk to everybody next month.